Welcome back to Grit. This week we are talking with award-winning organisational psychologist Dr. Hayley Lewis. In this episode we discuss the principles of leadership and management, psychological safety in the workplace, and all the challenges and opportunities this brings to the creative industries. It was a fascinating chat full of lots of insight and lots of top tips. Great, so we're going to jump over to England now to talk to Dr. Hayley Lewis. I'm really glad that we're having a chance to talk to you because psychology, management, HR, all of these things come up in many of the conversations I've had with people in the creative industries, and therefore I wanted an expert to talk about this, and I'll share it in the show notes. I was particularly drawn to you because of the sketch notes that you put out of these concepts that take things that are maybe complicated to people in psychological terms and actually boils it down to its essence. So welcome, Hayley. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for asking me. I'm really excited about where our conversation goes,
John. As I was saying, like, we've had a lot of problems in the creative industries I think for a long time, but it's come into a sharp focus of kind of toxic behaviours in the workplace and mental health struggles and so forth. And I wonder sometimes whether it's actually issues of management and understanding of management. I'm just wondering, like, from your discussions and your insights, what are often the things that kind of go wrong in management that brings around some of these psychological challenges? And are they unique to certain industries, or are they just pervasive across all industries?
So I'll start at the end. So first of all, they're not unique to certainly the creative industry. I work across all sectors and across different geographical boundaries and sizes of organisations. And I come across toxic cultures and ineffective managers in all walks of life. So, but I also come across brilliant examples of management and leadership and brilliant examples of healthy, productive organisational cultures. And I think that's always a good starting place for any of us, is to look at what others, the best in the business, are doing and what can we learn and take from those. I think when you boil it down, to use your phrase, when you boil it down into its essence, as humans, we're geared from when we're babies to learn from role models, and it's no different from when we're adults. And so one of the things I always say to my students and to my clients is, what can we learn from others? Have a look around and let's see what we can kind of take away from that.
Because, and I think that's very true. In my own experience, it took a long time before I ever saw what a good manager was, because it tends to be, again, in the creative fields, people get elevated because of their creativity, not necessarily because of their management. And this is true in other sectors as well. And is there a case sometimes in organizations that people think management is some kind of natural thing that just you have it? Or like, there doesn't seem to be enough emphasis in certain places, and particularly even at school, about what management is?
So, great question, John. I think there's actually two fables, if you like, for want of a better term, that I see around management. The first, you're absolutely spot on, that anyone can step into that, and it's kind of endemic of where we are societally, culturally, that the only way you can often progress and get into more senior positions or earn more money is to take on a management role. But it doesn't necessarily mean that's the right role for you, which we'll come to in a second. The other fable that I see, and I think it goes to the heart of what you've just touched on, is management's not sexy. It's all about leadership. You know, you only have to look on LinkedIn and everything's about leadership and leaders. And you put the term leadership or leadership development into Google and you get, you know, 250 million hits, and management is often seen as the poor relation, the boring, staid, brown cardigan, unsexy aspect of working life. And I've made it my life's mission, my passion, to target and focus on and work with and give a lot of love to what I call middle managers, because as we know, and certainly as research shows and my own experience shows, having worked in corporate life and working with lots of clients, middle managers can make life very, very difficult in organisations, or very, very easy. And a big part of that is the investment and time we put into everything from how we select those people right through to how we develop them and challenge them and support them.
It's good that you raised the kind of issue about leadership and management. What would you define as the are the differences between the two? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, so it's funny, actually. I was running an event last week for women in leadership, and we talked exactly about this. There's a book by a guy called John Cotter. He's a Harvard researcher. It's called Leading Change. And in his book, he separates out management and leadership. Now, he puts them into two boxes. I don't like that. Anybody who's ever worked with me knows I love a Venn diagram because life's a bit more nuanced than that. So I've basically taken his model and turned it into a Venn diagram. So there are some differences, but there are also some overlaps. So for management, you know, John Cotter talks about that is about predictability. That's about making sure your budget is well managed, risks are identified and managed. That's about your hiring and recruitment, the mechanics, if you like. Then you've got leadership, which is about inspiring change. And so that's about motivating people, setting a really clear vision. It's about the future. It's about kind of motivating and engaging people. And for me, the bit in between, the overlap between the two, it doesn't matter what hat you have on, I think I love a bit of alliteration. So I call it the four C's, which is courage, compassion, common sense and communication. So it doesn't matter if you're in your leadership mode or a pure leadership role or in management mode or a pure management role. Those four things are crucial regardless. And I work with lots of people. And in fact, I was in that kind of role myself when I was in the public sector where I had a foot in both camps. I was really senior, being paid a lot of money, but I had responsibility for both. You know, I had management responsibility to keep a steady ship with my service, but I had leadership responsibility in terms of setting strategic vision for my area, in terms of kind of inspiring and motivating staff. And certainly many of my clients fall into that. So yeah, I don't like boxes. I think there's an overlap, but hopefully that gives your listeners a broad sense of what we mean by management, what we mean by leadership, and where the two overlap.
And sometimes I think you can come across an over-led, under-managed culture, or sometimes an over-managed and under-led culture. And is it getting the balance right?
Absolutely spot on. I've worked with and in organisations where, and this goes back to my point at the beginning, where because it's all about leadership and everybody wants to be a leader and even if you don't necessarily have to be in a position of leadership, you can still be a leader. But that's the kind of that's the thing that everyone wants to do and be. And as you say, it can often be at the expense of making sure your budgets are balanced, making sure that you've got enough staff, making sure that demand isn't outstripping kind of resource. And if you take your eye off that, very quickly, you'll see organisational culture degenerate into toxicity. And more fundamentally, it impacts performance and ultimately impacts the service to customers or to an audience. You know, it can impact creativity in terms of programme making. It can just have an impact on so many things. So you're absolutely spot on, John. It has to be a balance between the two. And one isn't better than the other.
And I think in recent years, maybe we've started to understand the effects of culture and the effect of leader on culture and how culture actually is connected to performance. Because I think there was this old-fashioned way of, like, as long as the leader was cracking a whip, everything worked okay. And I'm just wondering, like, what's the kind of... We don't really work in the Industrial Revolution anymore. So what kind of factors need to be in place for the kind of work that most people do now, culturally and so forth?
Well, so I get asked this question a lot around what does a good culture look like? And my answer is, like a typical psychologist, it depends. So because there's so many contextual factors to take into account, what's the sector, what's the country or countries, because, you know, you've got geographical, if you're a global organisation. So I worked at the BBC for 7 years and that's a global organisation. And so you have to understand and take into account geographical, ethnic, cultural differences as well when you're thinking about organisational culture. There's just a whole host of things to think about. But broadly, for a healthy, productive, happy-ish, because I think we need to be realistic as well. We can't all be happy.
No.
You know, Wizard of Oz, munchkins all the time. You touched on it earlier, John. A big part of it is leadership behaviour. So there's all sorts of complex models and frameworks about organisational culture, and they're useful for people like me who are consultants and practitioners supporting organisations, but can be quite overwhelming. So if I break it down into its four basest elements, so a culture is made up of leadership behaviour and style. It's made up of values, both in terms of what the organisation's values are, but also what the leader's values are, what people's values are, what matters to them, that they bring. What we call artefacts. So artefacts are kind of physical things. They're everything from car parking spaces for those who still have an office, who gets a parking space, who doesn't, who has a corner office, who doesn't, who gets that brand new MacBook, who doesn't.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like tangible stuff. What's the logo of your company look like? What kind of message is that sending? So it's kind of like artifacts are tangible things that can give off a message. And norms. So the unwritten rules. How does stuff really get done? You know, and norms can be everything from celebrating birthdays or not, through to how reports get signed off, or, you know, it's those unwritten rules. I worked in one organization where the unwritten rule, the norm, was nothing could go anywhere without being viewed, and I mean nothing, it was like proper micromanagement, without being signed off and seen by my boss. Didn't matter if it was the smallest, that was the norm. And if you stepped outside of that norm, you would be punished in some way. So there's a real power in spotting the norms. Yeah, artifacts. I've got a funny story. I was doing some work with a large organisation in the UK, and I met with the chief executive, and they proudly said to me, "Hayley, I'm really proud of the culture of our organisation. It's high trust. You know, if I had to say one word about what our culture is about, it's about trust. We trust our staff trust us." I was like, brilliant, happy days. And then I went on my travels, like I do, to gather data. And one of the things I like to do is just wander around buildings. This is before the pandemic, and look at signage, sit in like the main office cafe if there's one, and listen to the stories that people are sharing. And anyway, one of the things I found, like everywhere I went, were these signs about stop, don't do this, stop doing this. Like I went in the toilets and there were just signs about all these things you couldn't do, and there were signs in the lift, and it was all about stuff being prohibited and don't do this, and very kind of school teacher, which was so the artifacts that I was seeing. And there were like 78 HR policies. One of them was 25 pages long. And so in terms of the tangible artifacts that I was finding were at complete odds with what the chief executive, and he was a nice guy. He genuinely thought, from his vantage point, he genuinely thought it was a high trust, but everything else out there, distant from him, was the antithesis of that. And this is one of the things that I talk to leaders, so like chief execs and kind of board level about, is you got to keep it real. You can't be so distant physically, mentally, from what life is like out there. You have to be. Tom Peters talks about this. He talks about management by walking about. And I'm a big fan of that. Get out there, spot stuff, keep your finger on the pulse. It's one of the most powerful things you can do in a leadership or management position. So, yeah, those are the four kind of main ingredients, if I had to distill it down. And it's just really interesting. I think once you understand that, I would encourage anyone listening to this, just really start to notice stuff about your organisation. Just become like David Attenborough, become a bit of an anthropologist, just noticing and being curious about stuff and what words are used and kind of because words are really powerful. So I was working with an organisation recently, and every interaction I was having, whether it was one-on-one or whether it was in groups or in fact in some of the documentation, project documentation, it was all about war. It was like we have a war room and battle, and just that kind of language was permeating. And it was like, and is it therefore any wonder that you are in conflict with some of your partner organisations? And they hadn't even noticed that. And so that's why it can be helpful to get others to come in, because they might spot things that you have just got used to.
I think you need, in an organisation or in a project or whatever it is, you need critical friends to look outside. The term I was told when I used to take this perspective was positive deviancy. And this idea of kind of being able to step outside and look at it and go, you should do that differently, and be a bit kind of rebellious, but in a positive way of just pointing things out. And if organisations allow that amongst their staff, that's even better than always having to bring somebody in to point it out. You should be able to be open to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Margaret Heffernan talks about this. I mean, I rave about her book, Willful Blindness. So I was sharing some stuff on social media last week about groupthink. And groupthink we can see pervade any kind of organisation. And that's where we don't challenge each other. It's where we might notice stuff, but we don't say anything. And one of the things that she suggests in Willful Blindness, and it's something that I've tried out with some of my clients, is what she calls the devil's advocate role. So that is where in each team meeting or project meeting, or, you know, for those of you listening, it will be a creative meeting, maybe where you're coming up with a concept. Actually having somebody in a designated, you've got the chair of the meeting, but you have a devil's advocate, and they have absolute permission to ask all the difficult questions. Why are we making this decision? Who does this decision negatively affect? How is this decision detrimental? So basically all the gnarly questions they absolutely have legitimacy to ask. And just by dint of giving somebody that role, and if for that moment they have that permission to be the absolute pain in the backside, is so freeing. And it just means that no stone gets left unturned and starts to create a really creative, challenging, healthily challenging, psychologically safe environment, and great ideas can come out of that. And that role should be rotated, so it should be like a different person each time. For obviously, because this is audio, and I'm doing hand movements that no one can see, but they mean something to me.
But no, I mean, you raise a good point, and I've seen your sketch note on psychological safety, and I'd like to delve into that, because if particularly in creative environments, a huge essence of actually being able to be creative is you need to be able to be vulnerable, and you need to be able to throw stuff around that might not work, etc. And to me, that to be vulnerable, you have to be psychologically safe. And I've seen many, many creative environments where that doesn't exist. And could you explain psychological safety for those that don't know, and what the sort of identifiers are, and what identifies that you don't have psychological safety, maybe?
Yeah. So in a nutshell, psychological safety is about being able to try something new out, experiment with stuff, take a risk without fear of punishment or penalty or backlash if it goes wrong. And that can be everything from trying out a new program idea to pushing back, giving feedback to your boss that you might be a bit scared to do, through to having tough conversations as a team. Because I think there's this misunderstanding from a lot of the public that psychological safety is all soft and fluffy and let's hug each other and sing kumbaya around a campfire. And that's not it at all. It's actually about how you deal with the gritty stuff, how you can maintain positive relationships whilst not avoiding difficult subjects, not avoiding trying out and pushing the boundaries on stuff. In terms of the things that can help facilitate that, again, it's our friend the leader. So whoever the leader of the project is or the leader of the team, they play a big role as a role model, both in terms of maybe sharing their own experiences of where things have gone wrong, where they failed at something and what they learned from it, and also how they respond if something doesn't quite work. And so that's why it's so important we get in with and work with and develop anybody in those kind of leadership positions, whether it's first time leadership role as a project manager, maybe all the way up to kind of senior. There are other things that teams or projects can put in place. And I'm sure that some of your listeners will have this as standard around their creative process. So that kind of review bit at the end of something, when something's happened, what do we learn from this? What went well? What didn't go well? And if we could have our time again, what would we do differently? So actually having that as a standard practice can go a long way to helping facilitate psychologically safe environments. And Amy Edmondson, who is often held up as coming up with the concept of psychological safety, she certainly did her PhD research on it in the 90s. She talks about celebrating failure, and I think you have to be a bit choosy and strategic around this, but I think there's something around, we gave it a go, you know, we tried something, we tried to break new ground with this thing, and you know what, we gave it a really good go, and we should be really proud of that. So there's something about the rituals and the celebration that you put around that. There's, I don't know if it still exists, it was something that I used to share with my students when we did, when I used to do lectures on creativity and innovation. I think it was in Sweden. It's called the Museum of Failure.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
It's the Museum of Failure, and it's brilliant. I think it's still got a website. If you're interested, anybody who's listening to this, if you just type in Museum of Failure, it will come up with the website. And it's just a celebration of things that have been tried out, like blue, that like purple toothpaste. But it's just like a celebration of, here are organisations that tried stuff out. It didn't quite work, but let's celebrate the stuff. They were trying to push the boundaries on things, and here are the lessons that they learned. And I just think that's wonderful.
And again, it's the same. Yeah, the same with innovation. You can't just be innovative off day one. I remember going and helping a pharmaceutical company in Spain coming up with some promotional materials, and they were like, "We have a real struggle here with innovation. Let me show you our innovation room." And I went, "I think I've discovered the problem. The fact you've got a room where innovation is supposed to happen." Exactly. And it's amazing how many...
And then the moment you step outside the room, you take your innovation off. You're no longer innovative. Yeah, that's a brilliant story, John. I'm a great fan of stories. I was talking to someone earlier that I'm coaching around... Stories are a great way to help people understand and bring to life some, as you say, often complex, unnecessarily complex kind of concepts. And I think that's a beautiful example. I love
it. Even
that.
Had a timetable outside.
Oh, you will be innovative from until, 9 till
yeah,
10.
It's but,
and that is it.
But you can. It's funny how you can see how someone got there. That's the thing. And it's all good intentions.
It was the best intent.
Obviously, in the creative industries, and a lot of listeners are freelancers. So often when we talk about kind of organizational design, leadership, it can be a real struggle for freelancers and how to fit into that. Do you have any thoughts on like how freelancers should navigate some of these sort of psychological issues and being part of organizations?
And well, as somebody, you know, I'm self-employed myself. I run my own business. But I've also, when I worked in corporate life, I hired freelancers and interims. So I've been kind of both sides. And I think there's a 50-50 responsibility. I think there's a responsibility on behalf of the organisation and whoever the team and a manager is going to be of that freelancer to be welcoming, to give real clarity about how the team operates, around kind of expectations. So that's their 50%. I think the freelancer's 50% is making the effort to reach out, maybe in advance of their first day, building relationships with colleagues. I think being adept and quick enough at understanding how things really get done. So they're kind of the organisational politics. And organisational politics isn't necessarily a dirty word. It's just about understanding who are the key people to liaise with, who helps get things done, who do I really need to connect with, who can I build meaningful relationships with in a positive way? And just make sure you're doing that. It's okay to go out for a coffee with a permanent colleague, because it helps you understand more about the fabric of the organisation. And relationships are crucial, whether you're a freelancer or not. So anything you can do to spot who are the 3 to 5 key people that you really need to build relationships with, and then build relationships with them. You know, proactively drop them a line to say hello and that I'm here. And I mean, and for those of your audience that are listening who are experienced freelancers, you'll do that part and parcel. But maybe for anybody starting out as a freelancer, that's certainly a good place to start, I think. And setting boundaries.
No, definitely. And I'll come back to that in a second, because boundaries is a point I really want to cover. I can remember somebody telling me very early on when I was a freelancer, learn to be a good tourist. And I didn't understand what they meant at first. And they meant, well, you can be the loudmouth drunk in Torremolinos, or you can be somebody who's interested in the culture of the place that you're visiting. And that's kind of how you have to be as a freelancer. Just be a good tourist.
Oh, I love that. I also love a metaphor or an analogy. Love that. I'll be stealing that for myself.
good. And I think boundaries is something people, particularly freelancers, but I think new entrants into a company, etc., really struggle. And I think now, sort of pandemic, post-pandemic, boundaries of work-life balance also. I'm just wondering, like, if you could talk a little bit about boundary setting and how to protect yourself as well as give yourself.
First of all, I'm in real awe of the younger generations. I'm rolling my eyes even as I say that, but, you know, I'm 48, nearly 49. I'm conscious a big proportion of your listener base will be in their 20s, early 30s. So a different generation to me. And I'm in awe of that generation, because I think we're seeing a real groundswell of a bravery and preparedness to say no, and to know what you will and won't do, and to be unapologetic about that. I think one of my frustrations, particularly this year, has then been seeing the media around this whole thing of quiet quitting. And I've done a lot of interviews around that, including on radio. And this idea that quiet quitting is a negative thing, it's not. What we're talking about is boundary setting, and that's not a bad thing. Why should somebody work 7 days a week and be on call 24 hours a day? You know, no human can maintain that. I think setting boundaries is brilliant, and I think there's a lot to learn from those entering into the world of work now, who, as I say, are unapologetic about that. Boundary setting is something that I came to fairly late in my working life. I am really, really clear about my boundaries now, much to some of my students' annoyance, because I'm not on call all the time. But because I have lots of roles, you know, I work at a university, but I also run my own company. I have life. Yeah. And I am really unapologetic now, at the age of 48, in setting boundaries and not apologising for that. But when I was younger, so particularly as a woman, in a really tough environment, I had no boundaries. And so I would be accessible all the time, and I burnt out. I became really mentally and physically unwell. It took me a good year and a half to come back to almost like a shadow of who I was, and then another year or so to get even stronger again, because I had no boundaries. You know, I was working till midnight, often most nights, getting up at 4 just to get into the office for 5:30, just to keep on top of everything. Constant demand from politicians, because I was working in the political environment. A really unreasonable boss. It was just like a perfect storm of things. And because I didn't feel able to or was brave enough to set boundaries, it pretty much broke me. But the breaking of me and the way back is the story that I share quite a lot, particularly when I do stuff around resilience with organisations and with groups of staff, and particularly female leaders. who we know end up doing additional roles. Mm. They often do the other work at home. And my story, the story that I end up sharing, I always share it, A, because it's an act of vulnerability and I believe in role modelling. If we're asking people to be vulnerable at work, then people like myself should role model that. But also to give people hope that there's a way back and a way forward. Yeah. And here are some things that could work for you.
Nice. Because I think...
Stunned silence, John.
No. I was taking that in. It's... I think you're right. And as you were saying it, what really resonated in my mind is I've been questioning a lot myself recently that I teach in a subject and an industry where we keep teaching people it's a hard thing. You have to work 24/7. And I really start to think, should we be saying that? Like, should we be perpetuating the myths of the media industry? Because maybe as educators, we should be saying, well, wait a minute, media industry, maybe you should be a bit more health, like, conscious and sustainable and so forth. And at the same token, you don't want to give a false impression to students and make it sound too... It's a really hard balance to know how far to push it and how far not to, because I don't want to contribute to the toxicity.
But I think the very act of you sharing that just now is the first step, isn't it? And I think there's a real power in... talking about this. You don't have to have the answers. Even talking about this in your lectures could be really valuable. Again, you don't have the answers, but it could lead to a rich discussion. This came up in another podcast that I did earlier this year, where the topic was around more for less, and I talked about my own ethical conundrum where I'd colluded in that, you know, when I was in senior roles, having to make cuts to my budget, and often my budget was people, as in roles, but the decision, the politicians didn't want to get rid of the work, and so what happens is you cut roles, but the work is still there, and in fact new things come in, and I've been culpable of that and colluded in that. And I think lots of people in my field, so in workplace psychology, but also HR and organisational development, we have been part of that problem, albeit broadly coming from a positive intent. How can we get more out of people? How can we motivate people? And certainly the pandemic started to sow the seed for me. And certainly this year, I've been thinking about it more and more deeply. I read a brilliant book last year called Laziness Does Not Exist, which is by Dr. Devon Price. And that fundamentally broke my thinking around all of this. One of the best books I've ever read, and certainly the best, one of the best books in the 21st century. And very challenging. And it's got me constantly questioning, what are we perpetuating? And how can we push back at some of the unhelpful, toxic narratives that have been perpetuated? And what part have we played in that? So I think it's great that you're asking yourself this question, and I think that's a really good place to start.
Because I think, like, particularly with the worlds of AI and all of these robotic things coming along, people keep talking about, oh, people are going to be replaced by this. And I always had this sort of theory, like, if you only perform the function of a robot, then maybe you should be replaced by a robot, but that should liberate you as a human being. We shouldn't be boxing humans in more and more and squeezing more and more out of them. If the goal is to mechanize and AI things, then liberate people. Don't then just add new workloads onto them. Actually cut the working week and just, like...
Absolutely.
And I felt like the pandemic gave us a glimpse into that. Even just the people can never work at home, they're less productive. Oh, actually, that's not true. So it's... Yeah. I just wonder why we have this myth, or why we have this narrative, and why we have this story. And I suppose maybe some people who get to the CEO and that they did it by doing all of that, so therefore they think that's the answer. It's the same way as somebody with a PhD will tell an undergraduate, oh, you've got to do this, and they're talking at a PhD level, not necessarily at what an undergraduate needs. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's really insightful, John. And I think it was a report by Nesta, the think tank, I think it was about 5 years ago, and they looked at the potential impact of the rise of AI and automation and robotics. And the RSA's Future of Work and Good Work report for the government back in 2018, those two reports looked at similar things. And what they both concluded was that actually there will be some things that AI, robotics, etc. will never touch, one of them being the creative industries. Yeah. There are certain things that just can't be replicated because the human brain and the ability to think far outstrips any AI. Incredibly sophisticated and nuanced thinking that is required for creativity, for emotional intelligence. So there will be some industries that I think will weather that. I think there will be jobs and new industries that emerge that we haven't even thought about coming in the next 10, 20 years. One of the things that I've also seen, and I have done research in and do my research in, is around entrepreneurship and self-employment, particularly amongst women. And we saw a huge spike in people during the pandemic taking, I hate the term side hustle. I think it has all sorts of negative connotations, yeah. But I know lots of people use it. So taking their side hustle and actually making that their work, turning it into a business. And that's an act of creativity in itself. And we've seen a massive spike in people making the leap to being their own boss, whether they're a freelancer or whether they actually set up a business, you know, with a few employees. And I think that's brilliant to see. That is, as I say, that's an act of creativity itself. And I think it just offers some freedom and autonomy as well. And we're seeing people from all walks of life do that. It's not just, you know, what you would call white collar, yeah. highly educated people. One of my friends, she did her research on people who work in kind of factory settings, blue collar settings, who've left to set up their own business, creative businesses. We're seeing a massive explosion of that. And I think, regardless of what's happening with Elon, I think social media has opened up a whole world for people from all sorts of walks of life, yeah. and tapped into our creativity. So creativity, I think, is something that robots and AI will never truly take over from us.
And there's a couple of times you've raised this issue of the fact that gender and ethnicity as well, that the roles that they play in these in the psychology of people. And I'm just interested in your sort of perspective. And I'm hyper aware that, like, in Norway, we've probably had equality in the truer sense when I compare it to England, but there is still gender splits and so forth, even if there's better opportunity of equality. But it doesn't mean, I'm just interested in your perspectives on the role that gender plays and sometimes what it does to people as they're progressing.
And again, I think it will vary from societal culture to societal culture. So I'm talking in kind of broad strokes, but we know from lots of research that I call it the nice and good girl syndrome. Yeah. It's not a medical syndrome, but you know, we're taught as girls in most cultures, we're taught to know our place, to keep quiet, to do as you're told, and that you get, if you're good, you get rewarded. And so we take that into our lives as adults. Yeah. I talked about this yesterday on LinkedIn. I talked about this, it's a phrase that was coined a few years ago called the tiara syndrome. Now, you may or may not like that phrase. That's neither here nor there. Actually, what it's about is this idea that the large proportion of women believe if they just work hard, are diligent and keep their heads down, they will be noticed for a promotion or a pay rise. And we know that doesn't happen. And so the interesting thing there is then we have what we call the double bind, which is if a woman adopts what we call stereotypically male masculine, yeah. characteristics of assertiveness, being vocal, they're penalised in some way. You know, I got called a ball breaker once by a colleague because I had an opinion. But you're also punished if you're stereotypically feminine, so you're quiet, unassuming. And so a lot of the work that I do with women, particularly women who are looking to progress in their careers, is how can you authentically be yourself? Honour yourself, honour your background, honour your cultural heritage, honour your, you know, where you've come from, be you, but be you 2.0 in a way that helps you progress. How can you have a voice in a way that works for you. So it's quite complex and nuanced, and it'll be a different experience, as I say, according to all the different layers. So I get really irritated. It's probably the only time you'll see me kind of get irritated on places like LinkedIn. When I hear people go, be an authentic leader. That's easier said than done for some, you know, that for a white woman like myself, you know, I come from a working class background, but I'm educated. It's going to be slightly easier for me to be my authentic self compared to a black woman from a certain background. You know, I've worked with lots of black women who talk about straightening their hair as a way to be more accepted, not wearing the kind of dress they would like to wear, that they would traditionally wear with their kind of families. And so they can't be their authentic selves. And so I think we have to be much more challenging of the conversations we have around what does it mean to be authentic, and what are the things that can kind of impact and feed into that and feed into our lack of progression. You know, is it stuff around gender, our sexuality, you know, what's kind of feeding into that, and how can we help people at an individual level around that? So these are complex topics and often overly simplistic ideas. One size fits all approaches are often touted, and in my experience, they don't often work.
No, I think, yeah, having gone from working in a very kind of multinational company in the UK to then I live in a field which is very monoculture and very sort of white Northern European, it's taken me a long time to adjust to that, because I was so used to adapting and trying to take lots of and for me that enriched me as a human being, and then suddenly I was in this one culture where I'm very different in non-obvious ways, just because I come from a different cultural background, but because I look the same, everybody thinks I must therefore just get it all the time. So it's, and I wonder, this is something that I wondered about recently, are we getting better at developing people, educating people to understand this? Or sometimes when you look at the political spectrum, you think, oh shit, we're getting worse. So I just want, are you, do you think there should be more done? Like, do we do enough in school about kind of seeing different perspectives and really understanding our own biases, etc.? Because I always feel like the workplace is a playground almost, and you see playground mentality just coming forward, and you can tell what people were like as children.
Yeah, I think it depends on the school, and I think it depends on the locality of that school as to what gets discussed, how deeply those things get explored and discussed. I know some, you know, one of my closest friends, she's a head teacher of a school abroad in the United Arab Emirates, but she's doing amazing work. You know, she's doing amazing work exactly on this kind of stuff. I think it will be patchy across the board. And I think, I mean, you've raised the whole political, certainly in my life, talking to my husband about it the other night, you know, I'm a child of the 70s and 80s. I remember being in school in the 80s and we had talks about nuclear war then and what to do. There's not a lot you can do.
No.
Hiding under a desk isn't going to cut it. But all jokes aside, you know, it's seen a lot of turmoil, and this point in time feels like the most prolifically tumultuous and unstable. But from an optimistic point of view, where there is that kind of instability and extremes of opinion, that's often where change can happen as a result. And I'm curious to see what changes ultimately come about as a result of some of the stuff that we're seeing in the world today. I remain ever a realistic optimist that things will be all right in the end, and that we will all learn lessons from things that have happened in recent years. And I believe in the fundamental goodness of most human beings, and that most of us have positive intent. We want to do good work. We want to have a good impact on the world around us, through the work that we do, through our craft, on our families, on our friends. And that keeps me ever hopeful.
one of the things that, somebody once said, a lawyer said this to me, and they said, it's not that there's too much conflict in the world. There just isn't enough early enough, and people don't have mini conflict. So they build it all up. And I wonder, and this is true in work maybe, we don't deal with the small conflicts in a healthy way. It's the same in marriages. People, you know, 10 years later go, you didn't do the washing up in 1995.
That's so true.
And have we done...
I think that's wise.
Like, sometimes in school and even the way we teach children, sometimes it's like, play nice. And actually, sometimes we need to know how to disagree and resolve rather than let it building up.
Absolutely. Which is what psychological safety is about.
Yeah.
It is about exactly that, John. You're spot on about being able to navigate differences of opinion and still keep our relationships intact.
Yeah.
You know, focusing on making it about the problem, not the personal.
Yeah.
And I think that's often where conflict can degenerate from healthy to unhealthy, is when it starts to be attacks on people and their fundamental being, as opposed to what's the problem that we're both trying to solve, albeit maybe from different perspectives. Yeah, I think you've hit it on the head there.
Because nobody gets up in the morning and goes, how can I be an arsehole today?
Absolutely. Do you know what? I feel like you've been sitting in on some of my lecture. I say that all the time. When I do management development work, particularly when I'm working with beleaguered, hardened around the edges managers who've got lots of battle scars, that's exactly what I say to them. You know, you'd be hard pushed to tell me, unless they're diagnosed on the dark triad, you know, they're diagnosed as a kind of a psychopath, narcissist, Machiavellian, you know, most of us go in, whether we're working from home or however, we want to do our best. No one wakes up thinking, today I'm going to be an absolute nightmare.
Yeah,
I'm going to be a dick to everyone I come across. No one, in my humble opinion and in my experience, does that. There are reasons why sometimes we're not at our best. We can't do our best work. There's reasons why our relationships might go astray at work or at home. And the job of people such as myself is to get to the root cause. And what I find with in a lot of the work that I do is it's the symptoms that are being dealt with, not the root cause.
Yes, yeah.
Because we're impatient. We're impatient. I was talking to somebody about this morning. People are looking for quick fixes. Oh, could we just do this questionnaire? Could we just do the insights profile? No, well, you can.
It won't get...
Do we know what the problem is? Do we know what the... Yeah, you're putting a sticking plaster over the problem rather than confronting the root cause or root causes of the problem. And often the biggest problem for people at work is the boss.
Yeah.
And that can be a hard thing for a manager, for a leader to face. And my job is to help them face it and keep them safe and explore that, and doing that through stuff like coaching. So yeah. Aren't human beings brilliant, John?
Well, it's funny because it's the same as that. I think we get this in academia sometimes as well, which is, isn't it amazing how people are good students and that's down to us, but they're bad students and it's not?
Right. Another brilliant bit of wisdom. Absolutely spot on.
And managers do that all the time. It's like...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we know, I always do it like a Top of the Pops rundown. You know, there are six main factors that impact our performance at work. And consistently, across the research, over the decades, at number one will be the relationship with your line manager.
Yeah.
And every relationship is a 50-50. So, yes, there's things that you can be doing, but there's stuff the manager needs to do differently and be open to trying and doing differently in order to improve things.
Yeah, management isn't a hypodermic needle that you just inject into people below you.
So many people. I mean, I worked with a group in the technology industry, and a large proportion, one of them, I kid you not, said, I actually don't like people. And I said, well, why are you a manager then? Because I think you've kind of got to be curious about and interested in people to some degree to be a good manager. And it's the only way he could earn more money, and he needed the money for his family. And I think there's something about the system, about how creative organisations have been in how they enable people to progress and earn more money. And there must be other ways other than going into a people management role. A few years ago, I read something about, and I'm curious to know how it's going now, but I read something about Spotify doing an experiment where they had, so each person would have two managers. So one manager would be the subject matter expert, the kind of the subject expert that you could go to, and the other one would be the pastoral care, the stuff around learning and development and kind of where you need support and stuff. And I was really interested in that, because I think that gets to the heart of some of the issues that we see. Not everybody's suited to management, but everybody should have the opportunity to progress in some way. And being a manager can't be the only way to progress.
That was always a tenet of that. I can't remember whose principle it was. The principle of being promoted to your level of incompetence, and it's kind of this. You can be really good at something, so somebody makes you a manager of that thing, but you might have just been a really good mechanic and they should have just paid you more to be that good mechanic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe pay you more so that you can teach others to be mechanics. So like take on a teacher role or doesn't mean you have to be in a people management role. Yeah. So there's something about organisations being a lot more creative around paths for progress rather than the rather lazy, outdated, the only way you can progress and potentially earn more money is stepping up into a management and subsequently leadership role, or branching out on yourself and working for yourself.
And I think that's a wonderful, I'm conscious the hour's up, and it should always be an hour when you're talking to a psychologist. So thank you so much.
I'm going to turn the timer off now.
Thank you so much for your time. There's lots of wonderful insights there, and I will direct people to your sketch notes, because I think everybody should. To me, that's like the psychological far side. It's a daily dose of something that everybody needs. So,
I love that. I love that branding. Yeah, and people can request. I've curated them into free ebooks. So I've got around 180 sketch notes curated into different topics. So people can request them, and they're free. And they're free for people to use in meetings or in kind of talks and stuff like that. So
and likewise, I know some of my listeners want life coaching, want mentorship. I'll also drive them to your website, because I know you provide those services as well for those who are interested. So
and
I know that many creative people have those challenges. Great, thanks ever so much for your time. Lovely to speak to you, and take care.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye.
Bet on myself and I proved it. I know the industry ruthless. I'm really a threat for nooses. The Chevy you're driving is ruthless. Think I'm the one and I proved it. I know the industry foolish. Think we're seeing the movies. It really ain't dropping out of cooling. Look at me struggling, I'm right.